I had always liked reading about the 18th century, the Age of Enlightenment, and little did I know that I had an ancestor who played a part in that intellectual revolution that changed the world. My name was Judy Vandenberg, and I worked in university libraries, where I had noticed in 18th century catalogues the name Simon Vandenberg, but a name, nothing more. And I didn't think that any of mine travelled the realms of gold, and I didn't want to pursue my family history. However, my sister died a few years ago, and her children wanted me to write down what I knew of our forebears. Well, I did know that my grandfather, despite having a Dutch name, had been born in London. So I applied to the London record offices for Vandenberg birth certificates and wills, and I very quickly discovered that Simon Vandenberg, bookseller, bookbinder, printer, and publisher, who died in London in 1808 at the age of 80, was my great-great-great-great-grandfather. So I returned to my former haunts, a university library. I checked the 18th century catalogues again, and then I descended into the bowels of the Bar Smith, or down into the 900s, where there are the most wonderful books on 18th century London, the Survey of London, the Inhabitants of London, the History of Westminster. And they can be borrowed too. They can be taken home on loan. And then I went up to Special Collections, where there's a whole library on the history of European printing and publishing. There is also Cheryl down there, who has the patience of an angel, and she was never alarmed whenever I leapt up and said, "No, I've found something." And find something I did. I found generations of Vandenbergs in the book trade. And I thought, well, this is the most beguiling occupation, being historian to my own past. And the Vandenbergs were a Flemish family of wood engravers. And in the 15th century, they were, at the same time as Gutenberg was printing his Latin Bible, they were stamping out these little block books. Now, they were made from wooden engraved blocks, and they were printed with hand-coloured woodcuts and a little bit of text. Actually, it was paper production that held printing back in Europe. The Europeans just couldn't work out how to make durable paper. But in a way, these little block books, you know, are better than Gutenberg's productions because they were affordable and they taught people to read. As you can see, they're written in Plattdeutsch, you know, Low German, well, Dutch, and you can pick out a few words of them. Gutenberg's Bible, with its hand-painted illuminations, you know, is the most beautiful book. You know, it's a lovely, lovely work of art. But it cost 60 crowns, and it was a lot of money. I spent a considerable time in Leipzig, which was then East Germany, and the university library there has a copy of Gutenberg's Latin Bible, so I have had a good look at it, and it is the most beautiful book. However, these little block books, they told familiar stories which people could and wanted to read. This one here is the story of St. Catherine, the patron saint of education, so she'll look after us. You know, we're all here in good company. And you can see that she's got all her attributes, the broken Catherine wheel and the ring because she was the first bride of Christ, and her books because she was the, you know, knew so much about learning and so on, knowledge. But not all of the block books were theological. Here's another one printed in the Netherlands, and it is of a compendium of knowledge, and you can see the seven ages of man and the history of surgery and the history of medicine. However, printing presses were installed in the Netherlands, and I'm using Netherlands, the Low Countries, to refer to the United Provinces, what we now know as Belgium in the south and Holland in the north. Well, Adrian Vandenberg set up a printing press in Antwerp in 1500 at the sign of the great golden mortar in the marketplace. And there, in 1502, he printed in English Arnold's Chronicle. It was commissioned by a London merchant, Richard Arnold, and has lists of the inhabitants of London, what they bought and what they sold and at what price. And it does contain also the song, "Hurro, My Nut Brown Maiden." There's an original copy of Arnold's Chronicle here in Australia at the National Library. However, Adrian Vandenberg went on to print the Protestant works of Martin Luther. And this was at the time of the Counter-Reformation, when the Spanish inquisitors were very, very busy in the Netherlands. And along with many printers of Protestant works, Adrian Vandenberg had to mount the scaffold. He was executed. He was beheaded in 1542. So the rest of the Vandenberg family fled. They packed up their printing press, and up they went to the northern part of the Netherlands, what we now know, of course, as Holland. Now, life there was much, much safer. And that was because the Dutch built these ships. As you can see, they've got very narrow draft, but they're very stable, and the Dutch, with their knowledge of windmills, knew how to rig them and set the sails, and they could sail swiftly and safely all around the world. And a great maritime empire was, of course, established. These ships could also be turned into very, very effective warships, enabling the Dutch to drive the Spanish out of the northern Netherlands. And in this climate of intellectual and religious freedom, nurtured by their economic prosperity, the northern Netherlands became the European centre for humanism, learning, commerce and trade. There was a completely free press in the northern Netherlands. The works of Erasmus and Thomas More were printed, and the Dutch developed a new type of paper, the Hollander, made by beating linen into a paper pulp. So the finest books were printed in Holland. Books formed a large part of Dutch exports, especially to England. There were draconian licensing laws in England restricting the establishment of printing presses and censoring printed material. Copyright laws were introduced into England in 1710, and along with the licensing laws were administered by a very powerful cartel, the Stationers' Company, which controlled all the aspects of publication. Now, any young person apprenticed as a printer, binder, bookseller was bound to the Stationers' Company. So many Dutch booksellers came to London in the 17th and 18th century, sold their books and returned to the Netherlands. However, Simon Vandenberg married Mary Holder, an English girl, and established a bookshop in London in St. Martin's Lane in the 1750s. And for the next 50 years, he thumbed his nose, he cocked a snook at the Stationers' Company, and he published books which no other bookseller dared to touch. In the 18th century, there were no publishing companies like we know them, like Penguin and Random House. It was booksellers who were usually the publishers, unless an author could scrape up enough money to pay for the whole printing press. So the booksellers organised and furnished the capital for the whole business of publishing, you know, editing, printing, binding, and they shouldered the whole risk of the enterprise. Well, in 1760, Simon published and sold a highly controversial book, The Collected Works of Albert Radicati. One of the most radical of 18th century thinkers, Albert Radicati was born in about 1700 into a noble Italian family. But at the age of 17, he was forced into a very unfortunate marriage. Now, that led him into a confrontation with the church and with his wife's family. So he wrote a series of essays condemning the power of the church and the laws of property ownership. He was exiled and he fled to the Netherlands, where he absorbed the teachings of Erasmus and Spinoza, and that led him from Catholicism to Protestantism and then to a rejection of all organized religion. He wrote a series of essays looking at the Christian church from the point of view of a Muslim and a Hindu. You know, what sort of people are these Christians? You know, vampires, they drink blood, cannibals, you know, they eat flesh. Well, then Radicati went to London, where in 1732 he wrote his Dissertation upon Death, composed for the consolation of the unhappy, and he advocated suicide as a perfectly just and reasonable action. Milton had expressed the anguish of the human condition in Samson Agonistes, to live a life, you know, half dead, a living death. And life in the 18th century could be very, very difficult. There was no palliative care, no social services, so if you're old, sick, and poor, well, life was miserable. Suicide, however, was a mortal sin. Suicides went straight to hell. They couldn't be buried in hallowed ground. It was, and still is, a capital offence, and survivors of suicide attempts can be charged with murder. But Radicati believed that humans have free will and they should be able to control their own lives. So I'll read you an extract from his dissertation. Man is condemned to die from the moment he is born, and as the sort of death is uncertain and most sorts are very painful, a wise man, finding himself approaching his end through age or illness and not having the least hope of enjoying any more of the pleasures of life, would be wise to choose the kind of death which appeared to him to be the pleasantest. But this was criminal and an apostasy, and you can see the consequences when the dissertation was published in England in 1732. Radicati was forced to flee, the translator was sent to Newgate Prison, and the publisher sent to the Fleet Prison. So it was a very brave venture of Simon Vandenberg's to publish the dissertation in Radicati's collected works. It's a very thick book. Radicati was a very prolific writer. But as an epilogue, Simon Vandenberg included a translation into French of Jonathan Swift's Modest Proposal. This was Swift's very savage satire on the poverty of Ireland, where Swift proposed that the poor people, the poor Irish, could give over their babies so that the rich people could eat them as tasty morsels, and that would get rid of most of them and there wouldn't be any poverty anymore. Yes, well, it was published in French. Simon slipped it in French because the English, of course, they didn't like this sort of material getting out into the general public. Yes. Well, Radicati died in Rotterdam in 1735. But his writings had a great influence on the utilitarians and other radical thinkers of the 18th century, David Hume and Adam Smith, Jeremy Bentham, the greatest happiness for the greatest number. And then on some of the later pessimists like Malthus and David Ricardo. But however, on a more cheerful note, we have Tristram Shandy, the great comic novel of the 18th century. The author, Lawrence Sterne, was a gentleman of the cloth. He was a clergyman in the Church of England, and he wrote Tristram Shandy in 9 volumes over a period of 7 years, commencing in 1759. Now, in order to sell his novel, or to get it published, because Sterne was always very short of money, he hit upon the idea of giving public readings in the Ranelagh Gardens, which was a public park in Chelsea with a rather louche reputation. So on a Sunday, instead of preaching a sermon like a respectable cleric, off he went and he read aloud these spicy bits while he solicited subscriptions to pay for the publication. Well, George Whitefield, the evangelist and hymn writer of the Methodist persuasion, was mightily offended about this. George Whitefield had a tabernacle in London where he preached to 8,000 people. And when he discovered his Sunday congregations drifting off to the Ranelagh Gardens to listen to the Reverend Lawrence Stern, he wrote a letter in 1760 to Simon Vandenberg protesting about the profanity of Tristram Shandy. Well, Simon published the letter with a note that the original could be seen in his shop. I think Simon was selling Tristram Shandy as well, because I checked it in his catalogues. So Whitefield's letter was somewhat, you know, counterproductive, because Tristram Shandy became a bestseller. it's still in print, yes. And Lawrence Stern went on to complete the 9 volumes of Tristram Shandy, and then he wrote his wonderful The Sentimental Journey. Well, George Whitefield continued to preach. He made 7 trips to America, where he died, and where he was and still is highly regarded. His beliefs were instrumental in founding many American universities. There's a statue of him at Princeton, and he's remembered as the greatest preacher of the evangelical revival, because he awakened the social conscience of the 18th century. It was his followers who were foremost in the movements for prison reform and the abolition of slavery. And as for Simon, well, he became involved in one of the most notorious libel cases in British legal history. It was all on account of this, person. That's the Chevalier Dion de Beaumont, the patron saint of cross-dressers. Now, by predilection, he was a cross-dresser, but by profession, he was a spy. Dion was born in 1728, the same year as Simon, actually, but into an aristocratic French family who had a chateau and vineyards. Well, Dion later claimed that he had been born a girl, but his parents had to have a boy to inherit his estates. So they dressed him up as a boy, and he was sent into the army and then trained for the law. Well, he came to the attention of Louis XV, who invited him to join his secret service, Le Secret du Roi, like the Three Musketeers. But Dion's story is much more interesting than any of the exploits of the Three Musketeers, because off went Dion to Russia to spy for France, but he went dressed up as a woman, because French women had very elegant manners and were very highly regarded in Russia. And Dion became lady-in-waiting to the Empress Elizabeth, and he did so well at his spying that Louis then appointed him ambassador to England. And this was in about 1761, when England and France were still at war in India and Canada, so it was quite a crucial time. However, Dion loved the life of London, and the Londoners loved him, because he came with all of these bottles of fine Burgundy from his French vineyards. And the Englishmen became very talkative, and Dion relayed everything they said in their cups, you know, back to Louis. He was very pleased. However, Madame de Pompadour was not pleased. She was very jealous, and she arranged to have Dion replaced. Well, when the new French ambassador came, Dion wouldn't go. He just stayed there. And he later accused the new French ambassador of trying to poison him. And Dion had installed a printing press in his London home, and he printed a book, The Letters, Memoirs and Negotiations of the Chevalier Dion, in which he told all about these murderous attempts, and he revealed everything that the inebriated Englishmen had said in their cups. And he also hinted about French plans to invade England. Well, it was described as one of the most remarkable books ever written. In fact, Horace Walpole, in his Memoirs of the Reign of George III, related how Henry Fox used to lend his copy out by the hour. But in England, the French ambassador brought a libel suit against Dayan, but the case actually was prosecuted as the King versus Simon Vandenberg. In the law case, Simon Vandenberg was listed as the printer, and it seems as though Dayan had arranged for Simon to operate the press he'd installed in his home. And Simon certainly advertised very widely that he had the book for sale. Well, they were both found guilty of libel, Dayan and Simon Vandenberg, but no action was taken against Simon. Dayan, however, was declared an outlaw. So back he went to Paris, where Louis XV kitted him up with high powdered wigs and beautiful dresses and a pension, but told him he had to go right away from France. So back went Dayan to London, where he said that he was Leah Dayan. He was the sister of the Chevalier, and he became very friendly with the Prince of Wales. That was Prinny, who became George IV. Well, when the French Revolution broke out, Dayan lost his pension, and Prinny couldn't help because he didn't have any money. So the two of them used to give these exhibition fencing matches, you see. That's, you can see Dayan and you can see the Prince of Wales. Now, that was before Prinny became, you know, Beau Brummel's, you know, fat friend. And, you know, when he took his corsets off, his stomach hung down to his knees. No, he was quite lithe and lissom. Well, Dayan died in 1810, and all was revealed. He was a man after all. But his story lives on in countless books and films, and there's been a recent TV animated series all about his exploits. And the libel case is often raised as, who is responsible for libel? The author, the printer, the publisher, or the bookseller? Well, after this libel case, Simon Vandenberg had to cope with the laws of copyright when he published Joe Miller's Jests. At the beginning of the 18th century, Joe Miller was a popular comic actor who took the minor Shakespearean roles, you know, a witch in Macbeth, a gravedigger in Hamlet, pistol in Henry IV. He couldn't read or write. His wife had to teach him his parts, but he used to have a lot of asides and ad libs, and he told his own jokes. And when he died, someone or other produced a little copy of Joe Miller's Jests. It was a very slight edition. It cost a shilling. Actually, there's a facsimile over there which Dover published, and they were selling it for a dollar, and I paid $7 for it on eBay. But anyway, the book was all a bit of a fake because Joe couldn't read or write, and the book was published. It was popular, and the number of jests increased with subsequent editions. A hackneyed joke, a groaner, came to be known as a Joe Miller. Now, this is one. Do you believe Lady Frippery is only 40? Well, yes, of course I do. She's been telling me that for the last 20 years. You see, that's a groaner, Joe Miller. But Dickens was very fond of them, and he refers to Joe Millers in The Christmas Carol and the Pickwick Papers, and Joe Miller's birthday is still celebrated among stand-up comedians. Well, Simon Vandenberg printed a Joe Miller's Jest book, and the Stationers' Company maintained they owned the copyright and threatened to prosecute him. They didn't prosecute him because they had bigger fish to fry. In 1774, a Scottish bookseller, Alexander Donaldson, published a new edition of The Seasons, you know, those lovely poems by James Thompson. James Thompson, you know, we all know from the last night of the proms, because he was the one who wrote Rule Britannia, you know, Britannia rules the waves. But he also wrote these lovely poems which became some of the most loved poems of the 18th century and went into a lot of editions. He wrote them around 1728 and he died in 1748. And the copyright laws enacted in 1710 stated that literary property belonged to the author or the publisher for a term of 14 years, renewable for a second term of 14 years if the author was still alive at the end of the first term. Well, by 1774, James Thompson was long gone, But the stationers maintained that they owned the copyright and they took Alexander Donaldson to court. But Alexander Donaldson was a Kenny Scott. He won the case. And then the booksellers put up a bill to Parliament. And it was asking for perpetual copyright. You know, if the booksellers, the stationers' company, had the copyright, they just had it forever, ever, ever, ever. Well, the booksellers' bill did get through the House of Commons. But when it went to the House of Lords, literally London, girded up its loins. Oliver Goldsmith wrote an impassioned letter about its iniquity, and he had good reason. You know, Goldsmith, he was old Noll. He wrote like an angel, and he talked like poor Poll, and he was the most hopeless businessman. He was always in debt. He didn't make any money from his Vicar of Wakefield and She Stoops to Conquer. And he had a tremendous empathy for poor people, people whom he felt were exploited. And he wrote this letter pointing out how the stationers' company were making poor people pay a shilling for a little spelling book, which really was only worth about threepence. And Simon Vandenberg, he wrote a letter too. He wrote about how he'd been exploited by these stationers' company and how they'd tried to extort £500 from him and they wouldn't let him attend the book sales. In fact, they blackballed him. Well, when the booksellers' bill went to the House of Lords, it didn't get through. It was mainly because of the efforts of Charles James Fox, that maverick politician who was always the champion of the underdog. He stood outside the door. He buttonholed everybody who went in whom he thought might vote for the bill, and he engaged them in conversation. They all talked, and they didn't get in time to cast their votes. So, anyway, the defeat of the booksellers' bill did help to clarify the legal position of copyright, and it freed up bookselling, enabling booksellers to sell and publish a greater number and wider variety of books. Simon Vandenberg had always concentrated on publishing and selling art books and translations of French and Dutch books. In 1764, he had published a book by John Hufnagel, The Painter's Companion, which was a treatise on colours. And it was an extraordinary book because it was the first book to reveal how colours were mixed. In Holland, the Dutch painters, they kept their colour mixing as very closely guarded secrets. And Robert Boyle, on whom these experiments were based, he was always paranoid about anybody copying his work, so he used to write everything in code. So this book that came out on colour, was it? Now, however, Simon then had published one of the most beautiful and instructive books of the 18th century. It's here, this one, The Book of Anatomy for Artists. And it was illustrated with copper plates engraved by Simon's friends and compatriots, Michel and Gerhard van der Goot. Now, we have an original copy of it, and it's over there in the glass case, and we've also made some photocopies of pages from it. Because while directed at artists, it was a very useful textbook for surgeons. In the mid-18th century, surgery began to be practiced in hospitals. You know, it was moving away, well, thank goodness, from the barber surgeons and the likes of Sweeney Todd. However, it was a sin and a crime to cut up dead bodies or to have human remains on view. That's why doctors kept their skeletons in the cupboard. And so this book by Genga, published by Simon, it gave very detailed descriptions of the complexity of the human body. It's a study of man as a mechanism. And then he next published a very influential book, The Art of Painting by Gerhard de Lairesse. It was translated from the Dutch by John Frederick Fritsch. We have a copy of that over there. And he was very interested, Lairesse, in perspective and how he has a whole chapter in the book on perspective. Now, I had often thought or heard that the Dutch landscape painters and painters like Vermeer had these camera obscuras that used to project up, you know, all of the lines of perspective. But Leres doesn't mention it. He goes into it. It's all a question of geometry. And in fact, the Leres's book on the art of painting features in catalogues classified as a book on mathematics. But there you are, and there's another book of it over there. If I could, okay, I'll do that. Yes, because the century is growing to a close, and so am I. Yes, but however, Simon in 1775 found himself facing more legal wrangles because he published the collected odes of Charles Hanbury Williams, much to the consternation of William Pitt the Younger. Charles Hanbury Williams, born around 1700, was an English diplomat, you know, a wit, a man about town, and self-styled poet laureate to George II. He wasn't. He really disliked George II, and he particularly disliked William Pitt the Elder, because Hanbury Williams was a Whig and a supporter of Robert Walpole, the first English Prime Minister. Now, when Walpole lost control of the House of Commons in 1742, Hanbury Williams blamed it on the double dealings of Walpole's erstwhile protégés, William Pitt and William Pulteney. You know, the nursery rhyme, "Who killed Cock Robin," tells the story of it, you see. "Who killed Cock Robin? I said the sparrow with my bow and arrow. That is William Pitt. Who saw him die? I said the fly. That is William Pulteney." However, Hanbury Williams' odes are not, you know, gentle like that. They're virulent, venomous, and vituperative. They also, you know, bawdy ballads, you see. Well, in 1746, there'd been the dreadful massacre of the Scots at Culloden, and then the reprisals when the supporters of Bonnie Prince Charlie were hung and drawn and quartered in London. And this horrified Englishmen, even if they weren't Jacobite supporters. So Hanbury Williams and William Pitt the Elder were both vehement in their criticism of the brutality. But in 1775, Hanbury Williams was dead and Pulteney was dead. William Pitt the Elder was completely mad. And George III was king. And William Pitt the Younger was very much alive. And he was lobbying to become Prime Minister himself, and he didn't want a publication of all of these odes telling about the behaviour of his father and also what his father had thought of the George II. We've got some original copies of Hanbury Williams here, and we've made some photocopies of the odes, which you can read. But I shall read you just the first verse of one of the more polite ones, but I will explain that the old chapel was the name for the Houses of Parliament. And when you got into Parliament, you had a place, not a seat, and you were called a placeman, not a parliamentarian, you see. But this was at the time of the great vowel shift, and place was pronounced as place, you see. You say potato, I say potato. So I'll just leave you to ponder on what place rhymes with, because this ode, "The Unembarrassed Countenance," makes a great play on the fact that Pitt was, you know, so two-faced. He had one at the front and sort of one at the back, and they were both equally nasty. Well, it's to a certain old chapel, well known in this town, all the inside all rotten, the outside quite down, a fellow got in who could talk and could prate. I'll tell you his story and sing you his fate. At first he seemed modest and wondrous wise. He flattered all others in order to rise. Till out of compassion he got a small place, and then on his master he turned his... Well, you can read the rest of it over there, yes. Well, Horace Walpole, the son of Robert, he was a terrible gossip, and he wrote copious memoirs of the reign of George III, in which he described Pitt's efforts to stop Simon, you know, publishing this. In fact, William Pitt the Younger had an injunction out, but then realized that would create more unwanted publicity, so he had people going around all the bookshops, you know, buying up as many copies as possible. Yes. And you know, I have a daughter who works in publishing, and she often bemoans the fact that writing a book, that's the easy bit, nothing to it. You know, the trick is to sell it, you see. So Hanbury Williams Odes went into quite a few editions. And you know, the political ones aren't easy to find, actually, because they are a rather, well, bawdy. But they're over there, so you can read them. And remember, the 1740s was such an interesting time in English politics, because this was the time when the Westminster system was being laid down. And, of course, the Westminster system is the form of government followed in most English-speaking countries. Well, in the last quarter of the 18th century, the world began to change. Captain Cook discovered Australia, the French Revolution broke out in 1789, and until 1815, all of Europe was in the turmoil of the Napoleonic Wars. Samuel Johnson, the literary giant of the 18th century, died at the end of 1784, and in 1785 his library of books went up for auction. Well, Simon Vandenberg attended the auction, and he bought several items, including Cook's Voyages, for which he paid $2. Oh, no, sorry, 2 guineas. The popularity of voyage literature was started by the books of William Dampier, you know, a scientifically minded buccaneer who visited Australia. Now, the Gale Company has made digital copies of 18th century publications, and I have got photocopies of Simon's catalogues for 1795 and 1796. And I am amazed at the number and the quality and the prices of the books he sold. We have got reprints over there. And I was, you know, interested in the ones that he had of Captain Cook's voyages, because some of them, they went for 4 guineas. Some of them were quite cheap, you know, £2. Some were 6 guineas and so on. So they're interesting to look at. However, on the 28th of April, 1796, a sale of Simon's books was announced, and it was going to be held at the Globe Tavern in Fleet Street, together with the whole book stock of Thomas Paine and John Hayes. Now, these three, Simon Vandenberg, Thomas Paine, and John Hayes, they were the old booksellers of London. And the sale was by the hand of John Hatchard. He was a new young bookseller who just set up a shop in Piccadilly, where Simon had a shop, just where he'd had his shop. And Hatchard's of Piccadilly, it's still there. It's still there in London, selling books, the oldest bookshop. Well, Simon then retired. He had lived in the Westminster area for 50 years, and he crossed the Westminster Bridge, and he settled in Lambeth, where he continued to work as a bookbinder. His very near neighbour was William Blake, actually. And Simon died in 1808. He hanged himself, and it's sad to think of what despair, you know, led him to take his own life. However, he left as a legacy the story of a man from an old Flemish family who fought, you know, quite valiantly in England for a free press, for liberal copyright, and for libel laws. He also left a collection of wonderful books, you know, which he published. You know, I've become an eBay sleuth. I try and buy them on the internet. And he had some notable descendants in the book trade. His grandson, John Vandenberg Quick, grew up in Amsterdam, but returned to London as a young man, just like Simon, and he set up a printing press where he printed broadsides and ballads. But he lost all his money when he tried to provide world literature in penny instalments for poor people to read. His first attempt was Josephus' History of the Jews, which was, you know, written, I think, about 100 AD or something, and he lost all his money. But John Vandenberg Quick is famous as the inventor of many children's novelty books. You know, these pop-ups, you know, peep shows, cutouts, flap books, penny plain and tuppence coloured. And Simon's great-grandson, William Michael Roberts Quick, was a book illustrator, and he's recently been in the news because he did the woodcuts for the first appearance of Sherlock Holmes in The Study in Scarlet. Now, a copy of Beaton's Christmas Annual, in which this appeared, came into an Oxfam bookshop just a few months ago, and it sold for $20,000. But one in mint condition will go for 10 times as much, because it's the very first one. Now, this is Simon's great-grandson's depiction of Sherlock Holmes. There he is. But Conan Doyle actually liked that because he felt that future renditions of Sherlock made him look far too handsome. And not all of Quick's illustrations have that sentimental look. As an old man, Quick worked for the Nonsuch Press, and when he was nearly 90, he did the woodcut illustrations for the Nonsuch Mother Goose, and they're just like the hand-coloured woodcuts produced by the Vandenberg of Flanders nearly 600 years before. There they are. I bought an original copy of this Mother Goose. It's number 880 in a limited edition of 1250, and it's printed on Hollander paper. And I was delighted to find that my copy had belonged to Eleanor Fargen, the poet, the one who wrote Morning Has Broken. But, well, that's another story, and it's just one of the many discoveries I have made in my journey.